Hello and welcome to the Underwater Sunshine Podcast. I am, as ever, unchanging as the tides, which now that I think about it, I guess change every day. Yeah, high and low. Okay, forget it. I'm Adam Duritz, one of your hosts, and I'm here with my friend, the lovely and talented
James Campion. How are you?
I'm pretty good. And I have got a really cool thing for today, because this one came out of left field for me, and I've been, as I've mentioned before, doing a ton of research on Richard Thompson, not just his time in Fair Park Convention and the series of records he made with his wife, Richard and Linda Thompson Records, and his solo career, which has spanned another, 40 years since then. But also, it occurred to me I should check out, I figured a guitar player of that talent must have played on a lot of different stuff, and I started looking into what sessions did he play. And of course, that was a huge mistake because it is a rabbit hole. He has played on so many things, so many of them are so interesting. But here's the weirdest one to me. I've gone through his whole career, and I find some stuff that he did about 5 years ago, maybe 5 or 7 years ago, with this guy Emmett Rhodes, and it's him and some of the people in the Bangles playing on some stuff, and I start trying to figure out what the deal is. Who is Emmett Rhodes, and why are they all playing on it?
Why does it sound familiar to me?
Okay, I'll tell you. So, it turned out Emmett Rhodes was this guy. He's a kid. He's like 15 or 16 in the mid-60s. And he joins a band as the drummer called the Palace Guard, L.A. band. They have a pretty big, local hit in a song called Falling Sugar, which I cannot find. And then he teaches himself to play guitar. And as a guitar player who's now writing songs, he doesn't want to be the drummer in some band anymore. He ends up leaving the Palace Guard. The Palace Guard at one point is also the backup band for, what's his name, Don Grady? He's one of the kids on My Three Sons.
Ah.
TV stars making records was happening back then as well as now.
Yes, Ricky Nelson.
And
David Cassidy.
But Ricky Nelson. Those are great records.
Yes. And by the way, those Partridge Family albums are damn good.
And we have Ricky Nelson to thank for Fats Domino in some ways, because Fats Domino, although truly one of the greatest songwriters of all time, was not particularly well known until Ricky Nelson started covering Fats Domino songs.
Right, and it always he had that Ricky Nelson had that song Garden Party, right?
Yeah,
where he was asked to play at Madison Square Garden for Chuck Berry and all those guys. And I always thought, that's weird. Why is he there? But a lot of people give Ricky Nelson real credit, not Elvis credit, but real credit for bringing a lot of those great black artists into a more mainstream way.
Also, because Elvis didn't. I mean, Elvis credit is a little different, because Elvis did a bunch of songs, took the credit for writing them, or Colonel Tom did.
Yeah.
And they weren't as great to the artists. But, I mean, I've read interviews with. I'm a huge fan. I love Fats Domino.
Right,
and I've read interviews with Fats Domino where he says, people talk shit about Ricky Nelson, they can go to hell. Ricky Nelson paid for my house. Ricky Nelson, a lot of Fats Domino's personal fortune came as the publishing from Ricky Nelson songs,
right?
Because they didn't rip him off
at all.
And Ricky Nelson did two or three. He loved Fats Domino.
Right.
He's just a huge Fats Domino fan and covered a bunch of songs. Anyways, we're getting way off the subject here.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay. So let's get back to it.
As I said to Emmer, we do welcome the tangent.
Tangent.
Welcome the tangent here on Underwater Sunshine.
Okay. So now let's get back.
Let me get back to where we're going to. So he starts another band.
But he backs up a band. He's in a band that backs
up. He's in the Palace Guard when he's a kid. He's like 15, 16.
Right, and they back up a kid from
Don Grady, one of the kids from My Three Sons.
So now he gets in another
band. But he learns to play guitar and then begins to write songs, doesn't want to be a drummer for some band anymore, starts a band called The Merry-Go-Round. The Merry-Go-Round has a couple really big hits in the late 60s, at least really big, I guess, maybe in L.A. But as soon as I start listening to Merry-Go-Round songs, I'm realizing how familiar they are to me. And the first one I hear, I realize I know this song because I've seen the Bangles play it a billion times. And it's on one of their records, and that's why I know. And then I hear the other one, and it's like, I realize why Richard Thompson's playing on their record, on his record later on too. But I want to start off with this song, because this is the Merry-Go-Round from, I think, 1968.
I'm intrigued, but I must say, I think I know where you're going.
And this song is called Live.
Yes.
It's by Emmett Rhodes. In his band, The Merry-Go-Round, I think it's 1968, this is Live. Mm-hmm. So he's actually 14 years old when he first joins the Palace Guards. At the time, they're called he's the drummer. They're called the Emeralds. He's 14. He gets in an argument with them. He leaves. Comes back when they change their name to the Palace Guard. And he's in that band for a couple years. He starts this new band with one of the guys from what's that band called? The Grassroots and another guy from the Leaves. He starts the merry-go-round when he's 16.
Right, and this is in L.A.
In L.A. He's Which 17 they, when that song comes out.
And so they are doing an excellent job of capturing the Beatles circa 1965-66 there. I mean, that's a great British-sounding
Which is the year this
thing.
Is. I mean, he's composing all these harmonies and shit and these guitar parts. And he's just, you know, and he's 16. When this record comes out, he's 17, I think.
Right.
Maybe 6. I don't know. It's like, this is the first single. They have this single. And then their next single doesn't do as well. And I guess the record company, because singles were big back then, freaks out and puts out the record right away, whatever label they were on. And then after another year, he feels sort of stifled by this, and he leaves to be a solo artist at, like, right. 18 or less. But I want to play you something. Well, go. What
yes, I just want to say something before we leave Liv.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, because I was going to say that I had an interesting connection to this song. I remember this song vaguely. I think this might have been in a film or something in the background, because this is the second song, I just looked it up, on the first Bangles record, All Over the Place. I was working at a record store when that came out.
Is this on the first album?
It's on the first album. Okay. It's the second song on the first album. Because I ended up looking at it, reminded me of something else on the second, different light, the one that has the Prince song on it, Manic Monday, and Walk Like an Egyptian, also has September Girls on it,
right,
by Big Star, which is the first time you heard Big Star, or you heard someone yeah. play and then announce it, which is great. But I remember hearing Liv on there and going, why have I heard this before? It bugged me. And so I looked up his name. But back then, you didn't have Wikipedia or anything, so I had to go and really search this guy out. I don't remember the name of the band, but for some reason, that song, and if you're going to play another song, it might be another one that I ended up finding. But this guy wrote a couple of songs that were pretty decent hits in the late 60s. It got buried under with a billion other things that were going on in the late 60s, where people think of the late 60s as an experimental period, of course, the Beatles and Pink Floyd and Jefferson Airplane and even Fairport Convention, all these different bands playing long form Grateful Dead. But that was a huge time for pop music.
And well, the Beatles are pop music.
Yeah, well, I'm saying the late 60s. By the time the Beatles are off doing their you know, Revolution 9, these things are still being pumped out to a great effect.
But this is 66, 67.
Yeah, so that's even prior to
still pretty
to that.
Early. Yeah, and, you know, they're just doing Sgt. Pepper's, and he's over in America as a 16-year-old.
He's clearly, in L.A. with Brian Wilson doing Pet Sounds. Yeah,
clearly absorbing Brian Wilson and the Beatles, and it's not 10 years later even. This is the same year, the next year. He's pretty early in there. It didn't take him long, and at a very precocious young age, to be picking this stuff up. It's pretty impressive, and so this is I think this is the B-side to that song.
You got the B-side?
This is the B-side. Well, it's also on the record.
Oh.
But this song, this is what led me to them in the first place, but it's really cool. It's a bunch of harmonies, but also he's timing these backwards guitars in it, but they're lining them up in such a way that they're playing parts of the rhythm backwards. And it's a great song called Time Will Show the Wiser. So check this out. This is still the merry-go-round, 1967, 66, 16 or 17-year-old Emmett Rhodes writing, singing, composing these harmonies. I don't know if he's the lead guitar player or not, but this is Time Will Show the Wiser.
My mind keeps on telling me that this is no good. My heart is aching and tells me I should. And only time will show the wiser. For I've fallen in love with a girl that's not mine. If I take her, it will hurt him, the very best friend of mine. But I know I need someone to hold, to love. But my mind says I shouldn't, and my heart says I should. And I don't know which to go by, my mind or my heart. This is so confusing, it's tearing me apart. And I wish someone could help me, but the decision is mine. And my morals and emotions are hard to combine. And there is no easy way out, so I'll let it just ride to the day. I don't know which to go by, my mind or my heart. This is so confusing, it's tearing me apart. Time it will show the wiser. Time it will show the wiser. Time it will show the wiser.
Cool is that? I mean, there's almost no drum. I don't think there are any drums in that song at all. There's some percussion occasionally, but they're doing it all with a propulsive rhythm guitar part. Some of the lead riff is played on a backwards guitar at the beginning and the end of the song, and the harmonies, the composition on those harmonies is extraordinary. That is as cool as anything the Beatles or the Beach Boys are doing right then. That is a really incredible composition to me, and completely forgotten. I mean, completely forgotten.
This is not underwater. This is deep sea diving sunshine going on right here.
I mean, how talented is this kid? He's 16.
Yeah, it's like the zombies.
17 years old. Yeah. Yes, zombies too. But the harmonies are a little more sophisticated than zombies' harmonies. They're closer to the Beatles' Beach Boys stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. And he's got that great Steeler's Wheel kind of just over the Dylan kind of...
It's a little McCartney-esque, too.
Too, you know? Yes, absolutely. Again, something you could pull right off a Rubber Soul or something. But it's just, without getting talking about where, you know, how derivative that could be, it's of its time. It sounds exactly like the kind of stuff that people were writing pop records at the time were writing. And... to think that that was a B-side. I mean, how that's not a throwaway. They must have just grabbed something off of there. That is just as cool as Live, for me. I think it's just as cool as Live.
Oh, I like it even more.
I agree.
It's a spectacular song.
And it's got a lot, but the bass player in that is going crazy. He's actually playing underneath the vocal line. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Like every, you know, the way McCartney would do it. Yeah. So, yeah, that's pretty darn cool. Emmett Rhodes. So then, well, you can't leave us hanging.
I want to show you because this is what.
So where does it go from here?
This is what brought me to them because I want to show you the essence of cover songs is taking something someone else does and making it your own.
Right.
And I mean,
taking it away from where it was
and making it your own. And there's a reason that Richard Thompson was playing on his album, you know, 40, 50 years later, because on the very first song or the second song on the very first Fairport Convention record is that song, Time Will Show the Wiser. Somehow they heard it back then.
You know,
because they're music geeks like we are. So at the time, they're listening to stuff. And this is Fairport Convention. It's before Sandini's in the band. So you have Judy Dibel. But I think the lead vocal on this is Ian Matthews, who's the singer right then. The guitar player, of course, is Richard Thompson, Martin Lamble on drums, and Ashley Hutchings on bass, Simon Nickel on the rhythm guitar.
And I'm amazed at how much Fairport Convention, I was telling you before we taped, how much Fairport Convention kind of seeped into my head without really being a fan the way you were. And I know my neighbor Joe Vengen loves them. I told him about this podcast coming up. He can't wait because he loves Richard Thompson, his guitar playing. And
well, they had a lot of Jefferson Airplane, a lot of the Birds in them.
I didn't hear that either until I listened. So I'm driving home in that snowstorm a couple of weeks ago, and the GPS takes me off at 287. And I'm glad I did because some of my colleagues and people I work with took like 7 hours to get home. I took like three. Usually it takes me like 45 minutes. But I went through the back roads, you know, and I'm in these dark roads for like 6-7 miles with no human beings. Occasionally a deer runs through, I'm telling you. And the snow's coming down, and I'm playing nothing but Fairport Convention. I think I played the first three records on the way home. So are you going to play the first song off the first Fairport Convention?
Well, I don't know if I can't remember where it is on the record. I'm going to play that song we just heard.
Okay, because I know I heard it.
I'm
going to
play
ride.
The Fairport Convention version of it. So you heard that. The lead guitar riff on the Fairport version comes from that backwards guitar on the merry-go-round version. So you'll hear it's a very different version of it, but they completely rock it up, and it's very cool.
Plus, merry-go-round is a pretty cool name for a band. I'm surprised that didn't take off.
Well, it did a little bit, but then the next single didn't work, and that's all a record company needs. But the real reason, I think, is because that Emmett Rhodes left after this, soon after this. But I'll tell you, this is the Fairport Convention covering the merry-go-round, and you want to see how one band can take another band's creativity and do something completely creatively different with it. Check this out. I mean, that is a completely different song. They've turned it into this totally propulsive freight train of a song, because one difference in their band, they have Richard Thompson, who is like, you know, that's about 30 seconds longer as well, because they take the time to put in a billion guitar breaks, because Richard Thompson is just already at that age, and he is probably 18 right then. It's their first record, so I think he's about 18 years old, you know, around the same age as Emmett Rhodes, maybe younger. And he's already got this totally like searing style, but also like running through not just the normal Western scales, but he's going through
like an Eastern,
scales.
Yeah, yeah.
When
Who's the guy, the guitar player? You mentioned the Airplane comparing to him. I never can pronounce that guy's name.
In the Jefferson Airplane?
Yeah.
Jorma Kalkonen.
Kalkonen. Like that kind of style is what he put in a lot of those songs.
Yeah,
like
I mean,
Eastern flavor.
You know, and having the mix, you can see why people called them the British Jefferson Airplane back then, because the mixture of male and female, they got Ian Matthews on that lead vocal, but then when you get to a chorus or big parts, you have Richard Thompson singing below him and Judy Dybel singing above him. And of course, within a year from then, Judy Dybel would leave the band, and Sandy Denny, maybe the greatest folk singer ever, female folk singer at least.
Right, and that's the same as Grace Slick and Marty Balin were two lead singers for the Jefferson Airplane, especially in the early days. Yeah, it's funny because that song maintains. Now, the first Fairport Convention album is 67, is it not?
Something like that, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, so it maintains
it might be a little later, 68, 69.
Okay. So it maintains that period sound, but it is a completely, not completely different song. Propulsive is a very good way to look at it. They took the best parts of that guitar part and the driving bass part, and you mentioned that very McCartney-esque bass in there, and really made that the core of the song, the Fairport version, because it's in there. The seeds of that, the core of that, is in the original merry-go-round version.
But it's not. It's much more understated.
Correct.
Because the that guitar part that Richard Thompson's playing, is actually a backwards guitar thing that just goes. It's very understated on their version, but
it's almost like the merry-go-round version is just a basis so they can build these harmonies and have a nice vocal exercise, as opposed to what Fairport did there, which was create a music, which is what they're about. The one thing I noticed quite a bit, and without getting too much into Fairport Convention, because we will be playing this stuff in the future podcast, but I noticed binging them the way I have the last couple of almost for a month now. There's a lot of instrumentals on that record. That band is very proud of their prowess.
Oh, yeah. Well, they have maybe one of the three or four greatest lead guitar players of all time, ever. And it's going to be a part of it. And, he's so young then, though. It's like he's still figuring out what he is, you know?
And even when I heard Sloth, which is on
Full House.
Full House. But then you played the House Full
version
of it, which has the long jamming, you know, things. Even that version has a moment where they just go off for about six or eight measures.
Yeah, and they have Dave Swarbrick in the band then, too, on fiddle, who joins, like, sort of part-time around Legion Leaf.
And he gives it, like, that Irish Celtic.
Yeah, he's playing the fiddle, so that's another. And he can really play.
Yeah, no
so he and Richard Thompson can really play off each other.
They
but,
do.
Yeah, they have. But I got to say that Ashley Hutchings, the bass player in Fairport, on that version, first of all, whatever he's playing sounds like McCartney's Hofner. It's got that like...
Right.
But it also, it's so propulsive the way he's playing it. He's just like driving it. I just think he's really great.
I've been watching this documentary. You know those documentaries under review that they have? They're all on Amazon now.
Uh-huh.
They're done by an English company, and they have like all these English, these British journalists and also the artists talking on it. Anyway, there's one on Nick Drake. And it covers all three records. And it turns out the guys in Fairport, I know that famously he opened for Fairport and bombed badly because, you know, he could barely, you know, he was very nervous. But in there, I didn't realize that the drummer and bass player for Fairport played on a couple of those records, on the recordings for. I had no idea.
It's Dave Pegg and Dave Maddox. Dave, they're both later. They joined Fairport later. I think they're on that record. I know Richard Thompson is certainly on the first two records for sure. Danny Thompson plays a lot on those records too, the bass player, who plays with a lot of people. Also on a lot of John Martin records,
right.
Mostly Danny Thompson plays a lot. He toured for years and did some records with Richard Thompson too.
So it's almost like, you know, in a way, it's almost like the Wrecking Crew, but live. Like, these guys were playing live in a band, but they were also available to other people to make their records much better.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the Fairport people played on Sandy Denny's records when she went solo after she left the band. A lot of famous British bands. I mean, Ashley Hutchings leaves Fairport Convention after Legion Leaf and starts Steel Eye Span.
Oh, so he left that band after the second record?
No, the fourth, maybe?
Legion Leaf is the
fourth record. All they made three records in 1969, so it gets confusing. They released What We Did on Our Holidays.
Which is a cover album.
It's got... I mean, a lot of their albums have covers because they do a lot of traditional songs, too.
Right.
But it's got lots of stuff. Meet on the Ledge is from What We Did on Our Holidays.
Oh, right.
Then they released Unhalf Bricking. And then right after Unhalf Bricking, I think before it even came out, when they were getting ready to start touring, there's an accident and people are killed, and I'm going to talk about this more in that other podcast.
Yeah, sure.
But then they also release Legion Leaf that year. Dave Pegg joins the band, I think Dave Maddox joins the band replacing Martin Lamble, who died in the car crash on drums for that record. And that's actually Hutchings' last record, I believe. I think he leaves to form Steel Eye Span after that because he gets really caught up. He's the main driving force between let's become a really traditional band and let's do just traditional English music in this electric format.
Sure.
But I think then he just wants to do that, and then the other guys, they don't all want to just do that.
But they're so talented. It's hard to keep a band like that together of cats like that that are really talented. They could all break off the way David Thompson did, or you know, Richard Thompson. They're capable of doing things on their own and then to stick together.
Ian Matthews had a solo career. Also had the band Matthews Southern Comfort, which covered Joni Mitchell's Woodstock and had a number one hit with it. Richard Thompson, Sandy Denny, like I said, Ashley Hutchings formed Steel Eye Span. You know, the famous British traditional band after that. And then the truth is, Fairport's still together.
Right,
there is a version of Fairport
that
still plays. They have their own festival at Macready every year.
It is amazing. Speaking of Woodstock, it's amazing how that song has had so many lives and so many hits with so many other people. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, most famously. But
wait, let's get back to Emmett Rhodes.
Yeah, let's get back to Emmett Rhodes.
So Emmett Rhodes, after this, he's still only 17 or 18 years old now. He decides he feels a little too restricted in the band format, and so he leaves and starts to record solo. He literally gets buys some recording equipment and goes home either to possibly his mother's house in the garage and sets up a studio. And it's funny, there's a union rule. You weren't allowed to be to release major label records and say they were albums unless you recorded in what was a legitimate recording studio.
Which were more times than not, were, especially in England, were connected. Well, this is in LA, but they were connected to the record company. Like the Beatles
a lot of them
had
owned
to record
by
in Abbey Road, which was
owned by
studios.
EMI then.
Right, right.
Warner Brothers. You weren't allowed, it was capital. A union rule, though, that you're not allowed to say, like AFM, I believe, a union rule that you're not allowed to say it's a real record or something if you're in
the
a home studio.
Right.
And so, like, this record, they lie about where it is. This is recorded. He decides to go and set up a studio in his garage and record everything himself. Play every instrument, sing every vocal, record it, compose it, do everything by himself in 1969 at the age of 18, 19
years old.
Right,
so he's basically being Prince, but in 1969.
Or Paul McCartney, who in 1970 does the same thing. Isn't that when his first solo album comes out?
Yeah, because the whole thing in Scotland, in his room, in a house, yeah.
And he gets a lot of comparisons to Paul McCartney around then, because he's, you know, obviously learned a lot from him and he's doing a lot of the same kind of stuff in the harmonies. And a lot of the things I read about this next record, or people saying this is the album a lot of his fans wish Paul McCartney had made on that first solo album, that they wish he'd gone out and done something like this. It's wild because these records are so hard to find. I mean, this one is a little easier to find, and it may even be on...
What label is it on?
Dunhill. ABC
I know
Dunhill.
Sure.
And
the Steely Dan is on Dunhill. ABC Dunhill.
Yeah.
Sure.
So he gets in a sort of a hard situation with them because I, the other ones I found a couple of them, but I had to go to eBay and I had to look.
Oh, you found the vinyl?
Well, I did find the vinyl. I didn't buy it. It's like some of the CD versions of them are hundreds of dollars. Of some of these records, I found this one, a Japanese import of it, the first album he made. he made it, and then because he had some success with it, had another hit on it, minor hit, called the song called Daisy Fresh. Whatever label the merry-go-round was on took some of his post-merry-go-round recordings and put it out after this and called it The American Dream by Emmett Rhodes. Even though the stuff was recorded and none finished merry-go-round stuff before he made this, they released it after this album, this next one, came out.
Yeah.
And then he got into a problem because I guess his record deal with Dunhill said he had to give them a record every 6 months, and doing everything himself the way he was, it was impossible to be composing, recording.
No digital recording, no computer. He had to engineer for himself. He had to mix for himself. He probably had to bounce for himself.
Doing all of that back then, there was no way to do a record every 6 months, and he got in trouble, and they ended up suing him for a lot of money.
How the hell did he get all that recording equipment into his house?
Well, people have garage recording studios. I mean, God.
The 60s? That was tough to have.
Sure. Where do you think, music from Big Pink? They're in a house, and all the basement tapes.
They did a reel to reel. You know, they used reel to reel. Like I think only 4-track.
Well, everyone's using.
That's
4-track
a good point.
Right.
That's a good point.
They start to go to 8-track at this point, but not a lot more than that. They sue him, and it gets really hard. And he does one.
They sue him for not putting a record out in 6 months.
They it's really hard on him. He does a second record called Mirror. I'm not counting the one that. The re-release, the American Dream, which I'm waiting for that to arrive, and I'm waiting for Mirror to arrive. He does a second album, and then he does another one in 73 called something Strangers in Paradise. I can't remember. And then he just gets frustrated by the whole thing, by getting sued, by the pressure from the record company, by a lack of success, and he just stops in 1973. And the next record he makes is in 2017 or 18, just this last year. I mean, he does some recording with Richard Thompson and some people back in like 2010, Richard Thompson and the Bangles, but that stuff doesn't come out. And he just put out a record this year that a lot of those people play on, and a lot of the people from Jellyfish, Jason Faulkner, Roger Manning play on it. And I just got it, so I haven't had a chance to listen through to that yet. But he basically goes from 1973 till 2017 without doing anything.
And he's in the prime of his... I mean, he's 24, 23, 24 at 73.
23.
So he's 23 years old at the height of the singer-songwriter period.
And he just stops because
he's frustrated
and because he's getting sued and because he has, you know, as a lot of things are, record
deals...
At
least he doesn't die like Nick Drake.
People think of record deals as the end, what you need, the dream coming true. But the truth is a record deal can be a horrific experience for an artist if it's the wrong label and the... But... I want to show you what Emmett Rhodes does in his garage by himself. This is a song from his first album, Emmett Rhodes, by Emmett Rhodes, 1970. He's now, I guess,
21?
Maybe 20?
Yeah.
19 or 20. And this is Somebody Made For Me, all by himself.
Somewhere, someone special just for me. Somewhere, someone special must be. Somewhere, someone special just for me. Somewhere, someone special must be. Somebody made for me. Somebody made for you. Somebody made for me. Somebody made for you. Ask and you receive. God in heaven, won't you help me, please? Somewhere, someone special just for you. Somewhere, someone special is true. Somewhere, someone special just for you. Somewhere, someone special is true. Somebody made for you. Somebody made for you. I've been searching all my life, yes, I've been almost everywhere. But the girls have caught my eye, but that special one's not there. Somewhere, someone special just for me. Somewhere, someone special must must be somewhere, someone special just for you. Somewhere, someone special that's true. Somebody made for you, somebody made for me. Somebody made for me, somebody made for you. Ask and you receive. God in heaven, won't you help me please?
You know what is so funny about that? So immediately this thing starts and I'm like, this sounds exactly like it could be on the first McCartney album. I mean, exactly, Adam. I mean, I just can't even believe it. So I went and grabbed the first McCartney to go through and I said to myself, real quick in the top of my head, because I'm a nut, what would that bump? Now, I would say, aside from, and you know that album pretty well, I'm sure, Every Night. Uh-huh. Every night I just want to get up. That song, Junk, which is a great song. He wrote it when he was in the Beatles. And Maybe I'm Amazed, that song would be right there. With those four, the rest of the McCartney album is not as good as that.
And it's the same year. I mean, these things aren't like the Beatles are showing him how to do it. He's just doing it at the same time.
Correct.
I mean, this is the same fucking
time.
He's
on the same wavelength.
He's in his garage by himself playing every instrument just like McCartney did on his first album.
Absolutely.
He's just doing it all by himself, and that's really,
he's playing
really
the drums,
good.
Obviously, because
he's a
drummer.
And he's a guitar player. I mean, it's learning to play guitar that makes him leave that first band because he wants to write songs and do it himself.
Right.
I mean, it's everything. And he's so good. And he sounds like McCartney, too, doesn't he? He sounds like Paul McCartney.
It's unbelievable. Can we play Every Night? Can we play something off the first Paul McCartney album?
Let me find it. But let's stick with Emmett Rhodes
okay,
for a minute,
yeah, yeah.
Though,
I'm dying. It's because I do want to play the combi. Because the deadness of the drums, the background vocals that kind of sweep in over like a real simple vocal, and the rest of it, it's amazing how, and I love that kind of, again, when I say dead, I mean the room sounds, we used to call it the living room sound. Like, you know, it sounds like guys playing right here.
Well, it's a small room. It's a garage. It's actually not a big echoey church. So
and
it
it's
sounds
not,
like what
it's
it
not
is.
A white, because he could have washed it in echo or reverb, but he didn't. Much like McCartney didn't.
Well,
a lot of people complained about that.
Reverbs aren't, you don't have a digital reverb back then. You need a plate reverb to do it. And in your garage.
Yeah, you need it on the roof or something to open
the
plates.
You're not going
to
have a plate reverb in your garage. You know, right. You don't have that. You know, and he's just, it's very creative. And also going in and out of the harmonies. Somebody made for you, somebody made for me.
Right.
Somebody made for you.
Right.
And that, which is, that's very McCartney-like.
No question. And I will say, in I think the greatest, aside from band album, like Band on the Run, The Wings, my favorite Beatles solo album is John Lennon's first record, Plastic Ono Band, which is just basically him, Klaus Voormann on bass, and Ringo on drums. That's it. And he throws in Billy Preston on God. But for the most part, but that album is produced. They did that album in a studio with studio cats. McCartney just was in his pajamas and by himself in Scotland.
Yeah.
Same with this guy. And that's why this sounds more like that than, say, Lennon's first solo album, which is considered a stark album, and it is stark. Especially lyrically, but it sounds like a record album. This does not. This sounds like a guy, great though, but in his garage, because that's the sound. This is the first time I'm hearing this.
Yeah,
first
yeah.
time. So my first reaction is, holy shit, this sounds like the McCartney album.
Like, it's the first time I heard it was a few days ago, because I'm going through all this research. I stumble into this guy, and I'm reading about it, and I'm thinking, what? And so I find on Amazon, I think I found the merry-go-round, and maybe this record, or I can't remember if I had to, no, I think I had to wait for this record to get here. I got a Japanese import of it that came in, you know, a Japanese import from 30 years ago or something.
Some guy was selling it on eBay.
Yeah, yeah, you know, but I'm knocked out by both of them. First of all, the merry-go-round stuff has songs that are on two of my favorite records ever, formative records for me.
Right.
And, the harmonies are knocking me out. And when you look at, and then it's like, oh, these people have been listening to, but no, these people are doing it at the same time. May have been listening to, but it's
in the zeitgeist. It's in the air.
It's pretty at the same time, you know.
Right,
but
he's grabbing it. He's, like I said, he's on the same wavelength.
Oh, yeah.
Creative wavelength as Paul McCartney. No question. Yeah, please.
Here's the first song on the album. This is With My Face on the Floor. Neither of these, by the way, is the single.
Oh.
Just
you see, that one, excuse me, is that sounds like a band. You, there's nothing on the first McCartney album or that last song you played that sounded like a band. It sounded like a guy in his garage playing a song, right, and accompanying himself. That sounds like Badfinger. That sounds like the Zombies or that keyboard part and then the piano. That sounds like a band playing. Oh, the Lovin' Spoonful. That sounds like a band.
Yeah, and it's not.
But it doesn't sound like a guy, but you know what?
It's a one-man Beatles is what it is. Like, I mean, it's...
Wow, this guy is amazing. I knew, this must have come up in a Robert Christgau thing I read when I was younger or something, because I remember Live, and I certainly remember it on the Bangles record, and I only know that Fairport Convention because... I can't say I heard it years ago because I've been listening to so much Fairport lately. It's kind of wiped out anything I might have heard before the last couple of months. But that sounds – I'll say it again. That sounds like a band.
Yeah, he's just really cool.
Two keyboards, a piano, a keyboard, bass.
And a pretty propulsive drum and bass part going with it, and some great harmonies again.
Yeah.
You know, and he's got that great guitar riff he's playing on piano. It's got like he's playing it like really ringing it out, single note piano part. I love that sound.
And because I said to you, is that a Rhodes? And he said, no, it's a piano. But the way he's playing it, it has an interesting sound, like a metallic-y sound to it. Something about that piano just sounds...
Yeah, it sounds... I think that what you're thinking
weird.
Of might be a Wurlitzer more than a Rhodes.
Maybe.
It's a little more... But it's not fuzzy enough to be that, though.
No.
It's got that ring of a piano.
It does.
It could be one of those, like... I don't know if Yamaha was making it. Those electric... CP70s. They're electric pianos that actually had a harp, you know?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me. I mean, but again, he's in his garage, so how you mic the damn thing, it will make it sound... And then you could probably be like, ooh, because it's a happy accident. Like, ooh, that sounds... I'm going to keep it like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it has a really unique sound to it.
To make this... One more thing about his production. You mentioned before, and you were right, music for Big Pink was 68, and they recorded it in Saugerties in a house. Big Pink. But they had... Garth Hudson was engineering. So he played on 90% of it, or 80% of the songs. But for the most part, he was sitting there with the machine and everything and making the levels and everything. This guy doesn't have Garth.
Well, he might have someone, a friend there, engineering. Who knows? He could have someone pushing tape
machines. Oh, I guess.
I mean, it could. It could be his mom. We don't know about that. What we do know is that he plays every instrument and he produced it himself.
Yeah,
you know, whether
true.
There's anybody helping
out.
But
it'd
out,
be so cool, you know, him just... I picture him like a mad scientist in there.
Yeah,
like.
I mean, me too. But I mean, we don't know that. We don't know. It could be anybody over there doing that. It could be an older brother or younger sister.
That. Yeah.
I mean, I think they should have put Somebody Made for Me. I was thinking they put this song Fresh as a Daisy, and it actually was a hit in Southern California right then. It's not my favorite of those songs. I really like it, but I don't like it as much as those other two, which I love.
I keep forgetting he's from California, and even though he does have a Brian Wilson sentiment to him. These songs sound. I mentioned Love and Spoonful from New York, but they were kind of like a British band. But it has like British sensibilities to it. It sounds Mersey. It sounds It sounds like an English band. Yeah.
Well, you know, especially because a lot of those bands were very. Those bands were very Beatles influenced. You know?
Absolutely. I mean, Badfinger basically. They were on Apple and their
that's
first
later
hit
too.
Badfinger's Paul.
Badfinger's well, it's kind of right now, 1970.
70, sure.
Yeah,
sure,
it's right around
that
time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But
if
he's
you
doing
want
this,
it, he
you know, more with the Beatles.
Correct.
Anyways, this is the single Fresh as a Daisy. Or do you want me to play Every Night right now?
Every Night would have been interesting. Well, yeah, you know what? No, you already announced Fresh as a Daisy. We'll play Every Night from Paul to give you an exact... Let's see how this is, because I don't know what this is going to be on. The first song you played reminded me of anything that could have been on McCartney. That was a departure. To me, that sounded... There's nothing on McCartney that sounds like a band's playing. It sounds like Paul's doing everything by himself.
Yeah.
But in that case, that guy did a fantastic job in creating the ambiance of a bunch of guys in a room jamming, playing a song. Let's play this one. This is the single. I'm guessing
single, Fresh as a Daisy, which was a pretty big, you know, mid-sized hit then.
Let me see if I recognize it.
But,
I doubt I would.
I didn't recognize it. I like this song, though.
Just as long as you're here to help me.
Fresh as a Daisy, the single off. I love that song. I actually really do like that song. I just don't like it as much as Somebody Made for Me or With My Face on the Floor.
Not
really.
At all. It sounds a little overmodulated, like there's too much stuff going on in there. It has a great – I love the verse better than the chorus. I like that modal thing that he's doing that. It reminds me of like Dear Prudence, doom, 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 doom. I love that. And then it goes, fresh as a daisy. It's just, it sounds like a car commercial or something, you know, or, you know, a deodorant commercial. It's a good song. It's got great melody, but it's not as good as the other two songs, I don't think.
I don't think it sounds like a deodorant commercial.
Fresh as a daisy.
I love that melody and the harmony on that. It's like, I can't put my finger on what it reminds me of. It's something. It's like,
it is.
I can't put my finger on what it is.
Reminiscent of something. But I don't like it as much as the other two songs. I don't know why. And it's funny because they picked it as the single. You know, invariably, we always choose the songs that are not the singles because we hear them all the time. But in this case, that doesn't apply. I'm hearing this for the first time. But I think if they'd have picked one of the – now, I will say this. That song sounds dated. It sounds like that period. The other ones don't as much.
Oh, they all, to me, sound like that period very much. But, yeah, I mean, because they sound like – They're McCartney. They're the record you kind of. I see what they're saying. They are the kind of record you wish McCartney had made in some ways.
I agree.
Wanted a little more of the harmonies and the Beatles in his first album.
And of course Paul did that. We've talked about that before on this podcast, but Paul did it because he was trying to differentiate himself from the nightmare that was Let It Be, because Phil Spector and John Lennon put all those strings on things and made it very saccharine. He decided to make a very stripped down record. He didn't want a lot of reverb. He didn't want a lot of harmonies. Yeah. So, anyway, you want to see the comparison of the...
Yeah, let's play the song. Okay. Let's play Every Night. This is from the first McCartney album, which is, strangely enough, called...
McCartney.
Every night I just want to go out, get out of my head. Every day I don't want to get up, get out of my bed. Every night I want to lay out, and every day I want to do. But tonight I just want to stay in and be with you, and be with you. Thank you.
day I lean on a lamppost, I'm wasting my time. Every night I lay on a pillow, resting my mind. Every morning brings a new day, and every night that day is through. But tonight I just wanna stay in and be with you, and be with you.
I always forget. I think that song is circa Abbey Road, because I think he had it when they were making their last record, because I'm pretty sure I have a Beatles bootleg called Leaning on a Lamppost about its outtakes from Abbey Road.
And oh.
I'm pretty sure that's on.
You know, I was just thinking about...
That's a line in that song. Every day I lean on a lamppost.
Leaning on a lamppost, you know? Wasting my time. Yeah, I was going to say that... you know, it's funny you say that, because what I was thinking as it was playing, I know the Beatles, the new Beatles White Album box set has a demo of Junk, which is on this record. And they do Teddy Boy, I believe in the film Let It Be. If not, bootlegs, I've heard. It's just a mush of, you know, memory now for me. But Teddy Boy he had during Let It Be, which would have been the same period as this. Then Abbey Road, they recorded after Let It Be, but it comes out before Let It Be, because they scrap Let It Be. And
yeah,
then
but this is after that.
That, yeah, 1970.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it comes out almost the same week as Let It Be. He tried to trump Let It Be. But yeah, so you've got... if that's the case, every night, Junk, he definitely had... They demoed it at the Escher demos, which is part of the,
right,
the new box set. And then Teddy Boy during Let It Be. And then I think he wrote Maybe I'm Amazed right around that time when he was in Scotland. So I was wondering about this song. It's funny. I never knew that he had it prior. But anyway, getting back to the sound of that, that sounds like he's playing right here. There's no effects. I mean, very little, but very... And I'm wondering in both cases... When they go to master something like this, I would love to hear the original unmastered thing, because that just sounds so good. Even today, that sounds amazing. Yeah. So, and that reminds me more of the first song that you played from Emmett Rhodes, in that style of the... I can't wait to listen to this whole record now. The name of this record is the Emmett Rhodes record?
Emmett Rhodes.
That's it?
Yeah.
And that was it. That was, you know, he did a 1973 record.
He did two or three more. Well, they release American Dream after that, but it's really from before that.
It's just a bunch of the stuff from Merry-Go-Round, right?
Yeah, then he does this record, The Mirror, and then I think one called Stranger in Paradise or something, Lost in Paradise, is in 73. The Mirror is like, this is in 70, The Mirror is 71 or 2, and I think the other one, the Paradise one, is 73, 4, 5, something like that. It's here, I can tell you for sure. Mirror is 71, Farewell to Paradise is 73, and then... In 2016, Rainbow Ends comes out. So, you know,
and that's the one with the Bangles and Richard Thompson.
It's 43 years later.
Now, does he do any of his songs from his early career on that record?
No, they're all new stuff.
All new stuff.
And I only had a chance to listen to it once. It's really cool sounding, though. It's got a lot of really cool musicians. Probin Gregory plays on it a lot. Probin Gregory, original member of The Negro Problem. Does a lot of the horns and the early stuff in The Negro Problem. Like I said, Jason Faulkner, Roger Manning, a lot of the Jellyfish guys.
Did they say what drew him out? I wonder if those guys did say, hey, man,
he'd been talking about recording. Like I said, he did some stuff in around 2010 with the Bangles and Richard Thompson, but it didn't come to anything. Like, something happened and it didn't come out. And so he had some songs, and, you know, who's else on this? Jason Faulkner, Probin Gregory, Susanna Hoff sings on it. Strangely enough, Amy Mann.
Oh.
Matt Malley from Counting Crows actually is credited as one of the co-writer on two songs.
Wow.
So, you know, I don't know what the deal is with that. I just noticed him on there.
Matthew Sweet and Susanna Hoffs did like three records of covers.
I have those. They're cool stuff.
Really good. Yeah, I like them a lot. I mean, obviously, they both love the same kind of music. So, yeah, it'd be interesting. It reminds me of the Jorge Calderon that we played. You know, here's a guy who had been collecting songs. He stopped. He made one record in 72, got, you know, dumped by the label, got chanted with the whole music business and didn't do anything for 30 years and then got coaxed out of it by Jackson Browne to play his songs that he'd been writing. I'm sure he was writing, like J.D. Salinger for years was writing. He just wasn't putting it out.
I don't know. I want to read more about him because I'm not sure that's the case.
It's incredible. This is an incredible story.
Yeah, isn't it? It's wild. He's quite a talent. I'll have more of that when I have more time to spend with the other records.
We'll play the new stuff. We'll play the new stuff with Richard Thompson on it when we do the Richard Thompson podcast. Yeah, that's a good idea.
But let's do a little more Garden Sessions as long as we're here.
Sure.
I wanted to play some James Maddock who also records and plays with Immer, and they have a little duo called Jimmy and Immy.
We played some of their stuff on the podcast.
Two records. One is live at Rockwood, and one was live in Italy.
Right.
But Immer had not arrived yet. He came in that night because he had a gig the night before out west, like in Santa Cruz, I think, with Monks of Doom. So he didn't get here in time for James' session on the Thursday. So James played with someone else, and I can't remember the name of the guy he played with. But he's playing this kind of weird electric mandolin, James is, and the other guy's playing some of that as well. And then they both play a little guitar, too. And this is a song which I've mentioned before, I think. We tried to cover this song when we were making what we did.
Underwater Sunshine.
Underwater Sunshine. Yeah. We were going to cover this song because Immer had played some of James' stuff for me back then, and I loved the song. And our version of it was so terrible that I stopped us after a few hours of working on it. I was like, you know what? I'm not ruining this song anymore. This is really, really – it was so terrible – that I said no and made a stop. And to this day, I still love the song. I love it more because we were unable to record it. As we just, it was fucking dreck. Just schmaltzy, shitty dreck when we did it. But this is James here in the garden playing it the other day. I guess a month ago now. Almost a month ago. Or 2 months ago, almost. October 11th. These are all from the first day of the Garden Sessions, everything we've been playing the last few weeks. And this is James Maddock playing Mr. Universe, October 11th, 2018, in the garden.
Where did I go wrong? She said. Out in the crowd or up in bed, I held her gaze and tried to explain. Words failed me again and again. If what don't kill you you're stronger. How come I'm so weak it hurts? And if that were true, all that I've been through, I'd be Mr. Universe. Send me somewhere to recover from my terminal disease. And if I grew strong every time I was wrong, I'd be Mr. Universe instead of me. There in the light of the living room, it couldn't end a second too soon. Was I wise or was I still a fool to throw away this precious precious jewel. If what don't kill you makes you strong, how come I'm so weak it hurts? And if that were true, with all that I've been through, I'd be Mr. Universe. Send me somewhere to recover from my terminal disease. If I grew strong every time I was wrong, I'd be Mr. Universe. I went looking for a face that'd brighten my day, and a lover that would fill the void. For a minute I was sure, but it didn't last long. I'm not an easy man to employ. To employ. If what don't kill you makes you stronger, how come I'm so weak it hurts? And if that were true, with all that I've been through, I've been Mr. Universe. Send me somewhere to recover from my terminal disease. If I grew strong every time I was wrong, I'd be Mr. Universe. I'd be Mr. Universe. I've been Mr. Universe instead of me. Instead of me.
I love James Maddock.
Yeah, me too. That song gives me chills every time.
I love him. What, that must have been an earlier record of his?
It's the second record it's on. I don't know. It must have been, because we were, that was 2009 or 10 when we were recording
when you
that.
Did that record.
Or before that even, maybe, when we did that record. So
yeah.
I can't remember when it was exactly. But
yeah, I said it before, you know, that Jimmy and Immy, I couldn't get enough of it. Immer gave me that when I was on the road with you guys 2 summers ago now. And I listened to that over and over again, and we played a couple of songs from that, I guess, to promote the fact that we were doing the festival. But I hadn't listened. He gave me the Italy one. I haven't listened to that yet. And they're both, I believe, on Spotify. It's great stuff. It's a shame, though. I don't know if his earlier records are on Spotify. Like, I hadn't heard that one. That's a really, really beautiful song.
I don't know. I have the records, so I'm not sure. Let's play another song of his while you check the Spotify thing out, and we'll come back and tell you whether they are or they aren't.
Yeah, we gotta you have to check
this
them
is
out.
This is maybe my favorite song of his. It's called Hollow Love.
Oh.
And it's just a great song.
I think I did play the Jimmy Emmy version of this on this podcast.
Oh, really?
Well, I love this song.
I love the song, and it's from The Garden, so this is James Maddock, the great James Maddock, Lester man, Lester fan.
It's mirrors and lights and machines that get paid. Hollow love, hollow love, midnight at the empty stadium. Hollow love, hollow love, full speed ahead. Headlights on. I'm stuck on the words that I don't underline. expect much, but I lose every time. I didn't expect to win either, that's true. All night I sit up and drink about you. Hollow love, hollow love. Midnight at the empty stadium. Hollow love, hollow love. Full speed ahead with the headlights on.
Yeah. Ah, huge fan. Huge fan of that
James
song.
Maddock, Hollow Love.
It's fantastic. I did look it up. First of all, James got a new record, 2018. If it ain't fixed, don't break it. Like that. They do have Sunrise on Avenue C, which is a 2010 album. But that would have been after you guys worked on your thing. But that this has got... doesn't have that song on it. That
on Spotify?
Yeah, that early one. Although Sunrise on Avenue C, which I did play with him and Emmy.
Well, it's a simple enough solution. If you want to hear this song, just go to the Underwater Sunshine YouTube page or One on One by Ehud page, and you can listen to them there.
Thank you for mentioning Ehud, because I wanted to say we were talking about production and working in your garage and how do they do it and sounding like. I mean, I have to say all of these recordings, even people who have I've shared this with. Commenting on that first. Oh, this is a really great song. I love it. But man, that sounds crazy. Because that's in somebody's house.
Yeah, Ehud managing to do it with like six or seven cameras. And talk about a one-man Beatles. Six or seven cameras and God knows how many mics. He's recording these all at the Garden Sessions. And
on the fly.
It's brilliant.
It is.
By himself a lot of the time.
And I was, you know, giving ourselves accolades.
He's got one helper with him too.
He does. But I mean, still, he's going. Hey, he's doing a free-floating camera. And he's recording. He's got headphones on. Because it's funny. You know, it's funny. So we brought my friend Johnny M in to record the podcast that day, those couple of days there. And it was frenzied. I mean, those 6 or 7 hours went like that. Between when we started around 11 a.m. to when we walked over to the venue, it seemed like 20 minutes. I mean, there was not a time. And I was joking about that with Katie and everybody, because there was a lot of people who wanted to meet me and I wanted to meet them and talk to them. But we had no time. They would be recording. You had to be quiet and listen. You wanted to listen to the music. Then the second it was over, they rushed him over to the couch. We did the interviews. And then, you know, Ehud's giving me the high sign. Okay, we're ready to go. You know, they're tuning up. They're
starting the next band.
Next band. Yeah. And but he's doing, because he said to me, you know what? You don't need an engineer. Just put headphones on. And I'm like, what are you, crazy? I got 4 or 5 people coming over here. I'll go mad. I can't do interviews and pay attention to what people hear. But that's what he's doing. I mean, he's not interviewing them, but, you know, and he's taking the photographs that appear on the website and on Instagram and everything else. Yeah, he did a fantastic job. But getting back to the sound of that, just a great, great, everything's so well separated. He's got bands in here, single artists. We had a harp in here, for crying out loud.
Yeah, Ehud Lazin is a spectacular man. And he's done stuff for years for the Outlaw Roadshow and now with Underwater Sunshine, but also just by himself, his one-on-one sessions, which we may start doing here from the house, a lot of them, from the garden. But he has been doing them for 5 or 6 years now at City Winery, recording every band, you know, so many bands, hundreds of bands. You really, if you get a chance, go to the one-on-one sessions on YouTube, and you can see there's hundreds of sessions there. And, of course, the Outlaw Roadshow and the Underwater Sunshine stuff is there as well. It's all worth checking out. It's great stuff. And Ehud, we'd be lost without him. There'd be no way. So many of the things that we've done over the last years with the Outlaw Roadshow and with this, we were only able to do them because of him. And he's been a good friend for a long time. He also is the videographer for Counting Crows and has filmed many, many Counting Crows concerts and recorded them. He was just in our...
He went to the session for August and Everything After.
Yes,
in London,
he was there, right? Filming the August and Everything After sessions in London. But he's also just came back from... He was in L.A. with Corey, our production manager, digging through our warehouse out there and finding, like... all the archived recordings from the concerts, which is why, because he filmed, what I really wanted him to find was you and I watched this. We filmed the Traveling Circus show at Hammerstein years ago.
That should be made available.
And
I'm sorry.
I've been just trying to get the multitracks because we can't do it with the sound on there.
Right.
It's just soundboards, not good enough. We need the multitracks to mix those because that is a great film. And really should be put out at some point.
Absolutely. But, and you and I talked about this before, just for the book and archiving. There's so many missing things. Not missing, but things that you would like to try to get. And I should talk to Ehud, and maybe he could be a point man to try to get some stuff for me for research for the stuff I've worked on. That's just kind
of... He's going to try to archive all of it, so we should be able to find anything from any date once he goes gets it all uploaded. So, you know, we'll see.
How long has he been working with you?
Oh, I don't know. I've known him for a really long time. I've known him since he came over from Israel. I don't know how long he's been actually working for us.
But he does a great job. And he was very instrumental in helping me. I do the post-production on these shows, which basically is just, you know, laying it in with laying the music, but also, you know, small tweaks, and Adam will review it, and we'll go back and forth. This is making the sausage, so I don't care. No one really cares about this. But in the very beginning, we had some audio issues, just the way the thing was set up and everything like that. I had never recorded a podcast before, and Ehud was huge. He answered every phone call, every email within minutes, and got back to me and showed me ways I can do it, because he works also in Sony Vegas, where I work, and we both work in SoundForge. He was showing me how to combine them, make it mono. And he, those first 4 or 5, 6 podcasts, when we were both, you and me, just trying to get our feet, technically, he was a big part of that. Huge. And I have to thank him a lot. I'm glad you mentioned him.
Well, also him and Lisa Labar, our webmaster, for many, many years.
Yeah, we never mentioned Lisa.
Big help in that.
Yes.
Because, you know, truthfully, Lisa used to just annoy the shit out of me. She had a fan site called AnnaBegins.com, and she was sure constantly jabbing me and telling me how her site was better than our site. Which I think it was. and I finally decided the only way to stop her was just to hire her away and make her our webmaster mistress, which she's been for many, many years.
She has. Here's a quick story. I know I told Adam this. How I met – well, before I met Adam, I sent – I guess Deep Tank Jersey, my first book, was out a couple of years. But I really enjoyed Anna Begins. That website was very good. There was a great chat room on there. There was great information on there. I had no idea she was doing it by herself. I just wrote her and told her, you know, you're really good at this. And she wrote me back and said, thank you. And I said, hey, listen, do you know the guys in the band? She's like, oh, well, yeah. And then I said, could you do me a favor? If I send you a copy of my first book, I'd like Adam to have it. And she said, great. And that's how
how I got Deep Tank Jersey.
Yeah, first called you, when the Aquarium put me on the line with you, that was the thing that made me feel comfortable, because I was looking forward to doing the interview. But you hadn't done national interviews in a while. You had gone to more independent weeklies at the time. So I was a big part of that. So you and I, when you got on the phone, I was like, and they say, you know, Adam, this is James Campion from the Aquarium Weekly. And you go to me, James Campion, did you write this book? I might have a book of yours. And I forgot I sent it to you. And I was so relaxed after that. And you and I got right into the interview. But yeah, if it wasn't for Lisa, you wouldn't have got that. And then I think I was about 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 episodes in when I, you know, I send them to Lisa, and I said, Lisa, are you the Lisa that ran Annabelle? It was all sort of formulating, you know, and she said, yeah. So that is pretty damn cool. Yeah, you have some great, great people that work
yes,
on
when
the
I, when
festival.
I said I was, I spent my life surrounded by a lot of great women, Lisa was absolutely one of the ones I was talking about because I have known her as long as I've had a career. And she has been tossing smart-ass remarks at me for the last 20-plus years.
including, my favorite thing is Adam comes up with all the, you know, the descriptions. And by the way, you're clever.
Whatever.
You're very clever. So, but not always timely. And so I will always get an early morning.
Thanks, Costanza.
Podcast? Or what's going on? And I'm like, all right, I'll text him. But yeah, she's always on the ball. She's always ready to go. And very professional, and you have some great. And it was funny because when you did write that thing a couple podcasts ago, you described it as women. She was like, "Hey, what about me?"
No. She said, "Absolutely," something like that. Yeah.
She accepted it as a personal compliment, of course,
which is what it was meant as.
Yes. Well, the great James Maddock. We should finish up by that. He is an excellent songwriter. Check out all of his stuff. Most of it is on Spotify.
I want to play a little bit more from the Garden Sessions because this is someone that really knocked me out. I had never met him before. But he came with a friend of mine. He came with Darren Garvey, who Darren played with Daniel and the Lion, Canyon Spells as their drummer. And he's one of my favorite percussionists, too. His ability to play with the band acoustically and just use a million percussion instruments to recreate a drum sound in an acoustic setting. He's an absolute artist with that. And he has been playing for the last few years with Elephant Revival, which was Daniel's band. Daniel's a guitar player in Elephant Revival and now is doing songwriting and singing songwriting on his own. But he and Daniel came out to hang out for the festival, and they both played sessions. And I want to play some stuff from both of them real quickly before we finish up.
Sure.
But I really love this song by Daniel. This is Daniel Rodriguez, formerly or possibly still, I don't know if they're on like hiatus, possibly still from Elephant Revival, singing one of his songs. He plays the guitar. It's called Growing Pains. The percussion and harmonies are sung by the brilliant Darren Garvey. Check this out. It's a song called Growing Pains from Daniel Rodriguez.
Hi, I'm Daniel Rodriguez. This is Darren Garvey. Little one crying as his teeth push through. Little one learning a thing or two. Just let them go this time, just let them fall. How you gonna learn to climb up from your crawl? Love for you so deep and it's wide. One day you're gonna have to walk away from outside. And your tears, and your tears are just growing pains. And we grow. Most times not without pain. The awkward one growing tall. Yeah, one day you're gonna see it all. For now, love is young. You found someone and your heart it overflows. But your heart it doesn't know. Most good things in this life they end. There's some things in this world that just don't bend to some greater hope. A hope doesn't hold a flame to just let them go. And your heart breaks. And your heartbreak is just growing pains. And your heartbreak. And your heartbreak is just growing pains. And we grow. Cross over the other side. Look down at your hands. Breathe deep in your chest. You know we're all just here long for the ride. It's lost. And this loss is just growing pains. And this loss. And this loss is just growing pain. We grow most times not without pain. We grow most times not without pain. Heartbreak is just growing pain. Times not without pain.
I really like that song, Growing Pains, and I love his percussion, but I love Darren's harmonies. He's such a good harmony singer as well. Just really complimentary, and I like that song of Daniel's.
Do they do this together quite a bit, or this? No, because it
I'm not sure
like
they're
they
both
do.
In Elephant Revival together, but I don't know if they've been doing this together for a while. They definitely came out here and did it together for the Garden Sessions.
They should
know.
Come for the new. Oh, well, you know, we actually should mention it's been announced now.
Oh yeah, we're gonna do the. We will be doing Underwater Sunshine in April. April 5th and 6th, or 4th and 5th, I can't remember.
5th and 6th.
5th and 6th, here in New York City. So we'll be going through all this again.
yes, the most exciting time of the year. Should be fun.
It is my favorite time of year, actually. It really is.
I was very, very impressed. I mean, I was impressed with the Outlaw Roadshow. I only got to see it once, the last one you guys did here in New York in 2016. But I was just so impressed by that. Everything ran smoothly. No one was late. Everybody, I'm talking about the bands, like clockwork ran. And the place was, as we said a couple weeks ago when we were reviewing it, the place was packed right from the very beginning. All the bands got really good audiences.
Yeah, it was great that way.
Solid audiences. And a lot of great coming out parties for Sean Barna was brilliant. Many people. Everybody was great. They really were. It was great. Upstairs, downstairs, it didn't matter. But these Garden Sessions are so special and so great to be they're being able to be captured, video and audio. What a thrill for the bands, too. Even established bands like Elizabeth and the Catapult and a couple of, you know, the guys from, name escapes me now, Marcy's Playground, they got a huge kick out of that.
And all the ones that we've played here on the Underwater Sunshine are up on Ehud's one-on-one sessions, and we will be launching the Underwater Sunshine YouTube channel ourselves with all the ones we've played so far up on it in the next week or so, I would think.
Oh, great.
And I want to play one more, because after playing with Daniel, Darren actually did a session of his own and played some of his songs, which I'd never heard his songs for, and I've known him for years and years as a member of Daniel and the Lion, later called Canyon Spells, and just as a friend, but I thought some of his songs were really good, and this is one of his songs, just Darren Garvey alone. It's called Wayback Machine.
This is Wayback Machine.
Thumbs hurt and my eyes are sore. I would never sleep if it wasn't for alcohol and plenty more. How'd we do this before? Swing low, sweet Applebee's. Skip down Carbon Copy Street. Watch the herd, it's all symmetry, as far as I can see. I'm somewhere in between. The future offers up a sweet remedy. None of the experts can defeat memory. Let's take a ride in the Wayback Machine. Let's take a ride in the Wayback Machine. Take a ride in the Wayback Machine. Reach back, there's rhythm in everything. Fed by a new routine of checking in and timelining. Broadcast on a pocket screen, dying to this scene. I'm somewhere in between. The future offers up a sweet
remedy. None of the experts can defeat memory. The cigarette in the Wayback Machine. Take a ride in the Wayback Machine. Let's take a ride in the Wayback Machine. Take a ride, take a ride, take a ride. Dust around the part of town where we knew most everyone. Turns out there's no more going home. Music is the strongest trigger, suffer sounds the loved one. And turn as known that bird is flown. And take a ride in the Wayback Machine. Take a ride in the Wayback Machine. Let's take a ride in the Wayback Machine. Take a ride in the Wayback Machine. No, no. Let's take a ride in the Wayback Machine. Reach back, there's rhythm in everything.
It's funny, he says it's rhythm and everything at the end, because it's so rhythmic, that song. The Wayback Machine, why is this bothering me? That was in a cartoon. Wasn't the Wayback Machine something?
Yeah, I can't remember the Bullwinkle and Rocky.
That's
they're the
Mr.
series
Peabody.
Of stuff. They had the cracked fairy tales, Mr. Peabody,
right.
His boy Sherman. They had the Wayback Machine.
The Wayback Machine. It's funny because that when you Google that, it's, you know, an internet archive. They call the Wayback Machine as an internet, so you can go back and look at old websites. Like you could find my website from 2000.
Oh, well, they
probably Anna Begins. Yeah, you can find, you know, whatever they have like photographs of it or whatever, digital captures of it. But yeah, that's right, Mr. Peabody. Yeah, the Wayback when you.
Mr. Peabody was the dog, and
the dog, right.
Was the professor, and his boy Sherman was
with the
kid.
Big glasses. The kid with the big glasses.
Or did the dog have the glasses? I can't remember.
Probably the dog.
Maybe
the
kid. I don't remember. Yeah.
But yes. So I immediately was thrown back there, and it was bothering me the whole time. But I would say that is for and it's just an acoustic song, so rhythmic, incredibly. The acoustic guitar is almost like a drum, in that sense.
Well, he's a drummer.
There you go.
They both have glasses. Sorry, both Mr. Peabody and his boy Sherman have glasses,
yes.
And that is why you remembered it that way.
Because they're, you know, the intellectuals. They
I really
are scientists.
Like that song.
It's a great song.
I like Darren's voice. I just like it. It's nice to hear Darren singing after all these years of hearing some backgrounds to hear him sing leads. It's really cool. That's a really good song.
It is.
I want to finish up with Car Aster. Now, Car Aster is a woman who played the very first session on the very first day. Of Underwater Sunshine here in the garden, and I missed the first song and came out during the second because I was in my room, and then this third song, it just started so quiet and it built so powerfully by the end, and it just made me really want to play it on here. It's called Spaces.
Sweatshirt's still here where you left it. Don't know what to do. Don't know what to say. And would it be wrong if I kept it? Used to loving you. Used to yesterday. The colors in my room are changing. Everything is rearranging. Have to learn to live without you. Tell me how to live without you. Now I'm left with all these empty spaces. Spaces. Have to learn to live without you. Tell me how to live without you. take a piece of me, afraid to let go and afraid to remember every part of you, every part of me. The colors in my room are changing, everything is rearranging. Have to learn to live without you. Tell me how to live without you. Now I'm left with all these empty spaces. Spaces. Have to learn to live without you. Tell me how to live without you.
That's Car Aster with Spaces. I love that song, and it just becomes so powerful. She was a drummer as a kid growing up on Long Island, and you know, her music nowadays is really more of an electropop kind of thing. But she kind of knocked me out playing just on acoustic guitar. It's pretty cool. I love that song.
Yeah, I was very surprised to hear. You know, I quickly Googled her, and I saw that she was considered electropop. Listening to that, seems like this is her natural idiom, but she obviously can do both because she's very comfortable. I'm not familiar with her stuff, but she's very comfortable with that. That is really beautiful. And I you know, it seems, we talked about this in the last podcast with Stephen Kellogg's work. It seems if you use something like Empty Spaces, you know, this, it's hard to live without you. I have to learn to live without you. Seems like a pretty obvious sentiment, using empty spaces to as a metaphor for the things that we miss. But she does it with such... same thing I said about Stephen. There's a genuine feeling when she's singing it that makes it real for me, that I completely relate to it. And I didn't quite get... I didn't have the lyrics here, what she says at the very end, but I like how it just suspends into, you know, she still hasn't figured it out. The song kind of just suspends, like it wants to go somewhere else, but it just ends, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very real emotion at the end that it builds to. I mean, and it's pretty beautiful. And it was kind of a great, like, I walked right out into that song, the song before it ending, and then that song beginning, and it was so quiet, and it built to, like, this heart-wrenching sort of thing, and it was a great way to start Underwater Sunshine. And it's a great way to finish this podcast today. So that was Car Aster singing Spaces. I guess we should take off. It's yeah. about that time.
Yes.
I should go get some dinner or something. And this has been the Underwater Sunshine Podcast. I am your host, one half of your host, Adam. That's my friend,
James. Thank you so much for listening, as always. Thanks to everybody. If you want to check out all the, as Adam said, all this music is online, the YouTube, the Underwater Sunshine Festival YouTube channel's coming up soon, but Ehud has it on his one-on-one.
So and it'll also be on the Underwater Sunshine Festival website, so you can check it out there as well.
All right, well, if there's nothing else to say, peace!
Late!